honest now, I wonder how you and I really feel when Sunday morning comes round again, yet again. Are we ever inclined just once in a while to think, if not to say to ourselves, do I need to go to church this morning? Or as Stanley Baxter might have put it, maybe I'll no go today. I'll just have a long lie. Will anyone miss me anyway? Or it's Gordon Matthew preaching today, I'll stay at home definitely. And I can always sit and listen online for as long as I feel like it and turn it off when I've heard enough. In other words, we don't necessarily have the same kind of positive attitude about joining the church family for worship. At least on certain days, we don't have the same mindset as the writer of Psalm 122, who at the beginning of our passage today declares, I was glad when they said to me, let us go up to the house of the Lord. His words reflect an eagerness to leave his everyday life behind and to gather with the community to worship God, a time set aside for a very specific purpose. What is going on in our lives when we do not welcome that kind of opportunity to come together, when we seem instead to be worshiping only as it suits us? Perhaps there may be very good reasons why we do step back from time to time because of family issues or illness. But I'm thinking rather of occasions when, in fact, we may be opting out and making excuses for ourselves. For we know that worship together is meant to be more of a priority if we are believers. And yet that's been a problem from the very beginning of the early days of the Christian church. In the letter to the Hebrews, for example, chapter 10, verse 25, the writer urges folk, let us not give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another. In the lofty language of the King James Version, we're told not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together. The suggestion is that some readers of this book in our New Testament were beginning to neglect this aspect of their Christian commitment. Now, the fact is that nothing that we read in the Scriptures suggests that believers are supposed to keep themselves to themselves or try to live without reference to others. What we do in church together is not the be-all and the end-all of Christian living, but the sad thing is that instead of seeing it as a privilege to be enjoyed, some may regard it as an obligation to be avoided. Instead of happily responding like the psalmist when they said to him, let us go to the house of the Lord, the comeback is, maybe I'll no go today. True worship is more than a solitary activity. It's too big for just one person. Perhaps our God is too small. Are we doing all that we can to encourage one another in that respect? It's assumed that the writer of this psalm is David. During his days, there was no temple as such, but he knew that one day it would be built by his son. In the first book of Chronicles, we read that David extensively planned and prepared for it. So it's possible that in the first instance, David is writing here of the pilgrimage to the tabernacle, which did exist in his day and was recognized as the house of the Lord. He knew, of course, that no building could contain God in all his glory and greatness, but he knew too that it provided an important focus for his people's prayers and worship as a community of God's people. And verse 2 in this psalm records the feeling of the worshippers on arrival when they could say, in effect, here we are, our feet are standing in your gates, O Jerusalem. It was the cry of all those who made that pilgrim journey. Those who followed in their footsteps came to Jerusalem because that was where King David first set up the tabernacle, the precursor to the temple which his son Solomon built. In certain places in Scripture, the name of Jerusalem and that of Zion seem almost, it seems, interchangeable, although strictly speaking, Zion referred to the hill fortress before it took in the city itself. Theologically, either name represents God's dwelling, his chosen people, the center of worship. Hence the hymn, which we'll sing later, "Glorious things of thee are spoken, Zion, city of our God." One way or the other, it all points to the ultimate fulfillment of God's kingdom and the eternal new Jerusalem. However, in the first instance, we're speaking about what here in the psalmist's time was probably a fairly small city, but with a dramatic setting for those approaching from a distance. It would have made a significant impression upon anyone looking up, hence the words in Psalm 121, "I look up to the hills and observing it," described in verse 3 of this psalm as a city closely compacted together. It was built in such a way as to give people the sense of coming to a place where there was order and harmony. A place where, according to verse 4 now, the different tribes which made up ancient Israel could come together to give thanks to the Lord. Jerusalem served as the religious and political capital of Israel, symbolizing their unity and their spiritual identity. Many tribes, one people. Which may remind us also that our Christian faith is in the one true God, although for various reasons we are divided also. God's people are meant to be interconnected and supportive of one another, like the stones of a well-built city. The last verses of our psalm today end with threefold instructions to pray for the peace and security of Jerusalem. And of course, that does obviously, in the first instance, refer to the holy city of old, to which the ancient pilgrims made their way. But I reckon that we can, as their successors, quite appropriately refer it to the city that matters to us wherever we live. The call to prayer there and then is a call to us also here and now to work together for the good of our city and for our lives together in the city. So what kind of response will we make? What can you and I do for our city, given all of its problems with which we are only too familiar? Perhaps there's not very much that we can do, but perhaps we can do more than we might imagine. Maybe the best thing we can do, maybe the only thing we can do as often as not, is to pray for our city. I have a strong feeling that in many cases, it is the prayers of the church in the world and for the world, the prayers of God's people, our prayers that actually hold things together and prevent them getting entirely out of hand. Or to put it another way and more accurately, it is God at work in response to our prayers, who knows, that makes all the difference. Jesus himself encourages his followers to ask the Father, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Our praying for the community, our city, our country is no small thing. So to sum up this far, and that phrase, by the way, doesn't mean that this sermon is almost over. To sum up, Psalm 122 is a collection, or one of a collection, of so-called pilgrim songs, as we've heard a number of times, sung en route to Jerusalem by those who had come to celebrate a particular festival in the Jewish religious calendar. Verses 1 and 2, I've suggested, express the joy of going to and arriving at the holy city. Verses 3 through 5 express thanksgiving for all that Jerusalem stands for and the special place it occupied in the life of ancient Israel. And the last three verses pray for its welfare and that of the people of God. What we read in this psalm represents the sentiments of all pilgrims, if you like, of times past. And because Jerusalem means more than the physical, historic city, it is a psalm which has been sung and read and prayed in many other settings and contexts. And if we are God's people, we are also Jerusalem-bound, if we can put it like that, because the way to Jerusalem stands for the way into the presence of the living God. And that, whether or not we ever make the geographical journey to Jerusalem itself, is the pilgrimage to which we are all summoned. We who read the New Testament today know from Jesus himself that those who worship the true God are not limited by geography. But for the pilgrims of Bible times, to go to Jerusalem was, they felt, to find themselves in the very presence of God. So this Old Testament psalm is no mere idolatry of a well-built city or an individual building of stone and lime, of marble and jewels. Without God's presence, there is nothing to make it special. And that's something which is worth our bearing in mind. Why, for example, do we as a congregation seek to build up our fabric fund with a view to enhancing our facilities here in Stirling North? If it is only because we have a fine church and a set of halls, which is true enough, and want to keep it that way for our own purposes, then we're in the wrong place. If we see our efforts, however, as a means of upholding the faith that has been passed on to us and witnessing to the reality of God, our contemporary, then we are on firmer foundations. Which is why we need to ensure that our faith is grounded in spiritual realities and not in material structures and sentimental associations. Whether it's known as Stirling North or Toasty Church or whatever, pray that people may know of our church, that God is in this place. Just as the psalmist of old, recalling what the holy city meant to him, said, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May there be peace inside your walls. Given the volatile situation in the Middle East today, it's clear that we must go on praying literally for the peace of Jerusalem, whose name first appears in the Bible story during the early reign of David, when he was attempting to bring together his northern and southern territories, looking for a neutral capital. He decided upon this place. There he built his palace, set up his court. There his successor built the first of the temples that gave the city its religious significance. From then on, of course, the name of Jerusalem recurs throughout the pages of the Bible. Here the great prophets Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Amos thundered God's judgment against the moral and social evils of an urban situation. Jerusalem fell in the 5th century BC to the besieging armies of Babylon. Many of its inhabitants were killed, others were carried off as slaves. But even in exile, the Jews looked to Jerusalem as their home and dreamed of worshiping in a rebuilt temple. They were allowed to return to their sacred city, but not and to enjoy freedom for long. As empires rose and fell, each brought the little Jewish state within its orbit, dispersing the people to every corner of the Mediterranean world. Yet, however far he wandered, the Jew was still drawn to that city on the hill. His one ambition was always to worship in the holy city before he died. And if he didn't get there when he intended, it was always a case of next year in Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, Jesus spent the last days of his earthly life. So in our imagination, we go up with him on Palm Sunday and enter the golden gate of the city. We travel with him through Holy Week to the place of the cross and the empty tomb. So no matter to what country we owe our allegiance, Jerusalem is in many respects our spiritual home. For this is the place where our faith had its beginnings with what God did for us in the life and ministry and death and rising again of Jesus. That's why it's so sad that there is such a dwindling number of believers left in the Middle East. Now, obviously, Jesus had not appeared on earth. God had not revealed himself in a human person when the Psalms were written. The glorious event, which we call the Incarnation, was still to take place. But when we consider the significance of Jerusalem city for the ancient Jews, we realize that they had some preparation for God coming into their midst, as he did uniquely in Jesus. I say that because they regarded Jerusalem very much as the city of God. It was, of course, known politically also as the city of David because of the influence of the nation's most important king, and it was a place where many of them had put down their roots. But even those who didn't actually stay there still felt it was their home, and to be there was to get as close as they could to God on earth. Hence the cry in the first verse of our psalm today, "I was glad when they said to me, 'Let us go to the house of the Lord.'" And that's why, as the psalm suggests, they got so excited as they made their way to Jerusalem on pilgrimage to be in reach of the place, to catch a sight of its walls as they drew near, touched them deeply. They couldn't contain their joy. Their God might be invisible as such, but he revealed himself to them through visible signs. All they needed to do was to lift up their hearts and look beyond the physical to recognize who was really there. We look at Jerusalem today, and it's difficult. With the best will in the world and all the faith that we can muster to look beyond the immediate and the very visible problems. No real distance from the once tourist-congested areas, modern Jerusalem presents a tragic illustration of the tensions, the hostilities, and the conflicts that keep people and nations dangerously poised on the brink of disaster. Not only is there obvious antagonism between Jew and Palestinian, which regularly flares into violence, there's a whole climate of suspicion and continuing disputes among residents over who has the legal right to live in certain buildings or areas. The city is more divided than ever, and in that sense is a microcosm of our human situation, because the one great fact dominating life on earth today is that of tension between people and nations. The world is divided and fragmented and torn apart by hostility and hatred. Our only hope is to look at the Jerusalem of the future. As a city of the past, it is a sign of what God has done for us. As a modern city, It symbolizes our rejection of God's reconciling love. As a city of the future, Jerusalem symbolizes God's own plan to bring to fulfillment the things that make for peace. The goal of history will not be some human utopia, but a new and divinely given order of life, what the Bible calls a new creation. The brave visionary who wrote the book of Revelation sees the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared and ready like a bride dressed to meet her husband. He describes this new Jerusalem of the future as a city of surpassing beauty, a city of moral goodness where only the righteous nations will have a place, a city of joy and sufficiency where the endless resources of God will meet every human need, where, wonderfully, there shall be no more death, no more grief, no more crying or pain, a city of perfect communication with God. This is picture language. Don't let us misunderstand it. It's truth expressed in symbolism. But it speaks powerfully to our situation as it did to those to whom it was written in the first century AD, to loyal Christians who were suffering terribly and could not understand why Jesus did not return to vindicate them. What the inspired author was trying to say to them, and what he says to us now, is that despite the often chaotic conditions of the world, our God still reigns. The struggle between good and evil, between sin and grace, will not continue forever, but will have an end. God, who created the world, who governs and redeems it, will see to that. He has all things in control. History does not move in circles. It moves towards an outcome, a joyful destination, which has been revealed in the life and ministry and death and rising again of Jesus. For the ancient Jews, the city of Jerusalem with its eventual temple was the closest thing to meeting God on earth. In that sense, it prepared the way for an even more focused sign of God's presence among them and us, namely a human person, a son of David, Jesus, the Messiah. It is faith in this same Jesus that makes it possible for us to keep going in the here and now. It is faith in him that allows us to pray that God's will may really be done on earth as it is in heaven. It is faith in him that encourages us to ponder the eternal city of God and our dwelling in it with him at the end of time. To his name be ascribed all praise and honor and glory forever and ever. Amen.